The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Does the Pentagon believe that China will try to retake Taiwan or take Taiwan next year or even this year? And has there been any shift in or new assessments on China potentially trying to take Taiwan in terms of timeline?
Thanks, Idris. So I'm not gonna speculate. I think President Xi's words speak for themselves in terms of what China's aims are when it comes to Taiwan. From a United States standpoint, from a DoD standpoint, we still abide by a one China policy. And our focus is going to continue to be on working with our allies and partners in the region to preserve peace and stability. And we would call on all parties to do the same. Thank you.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder during Thursday's Pentagon press briefing, speaking about China's intentions with Taiwan. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. It is good to be back here with you again today. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for hanging out with me for the next couple hours. We've got a lot to get into this afternoon, and just so grateful to be here with you. I really am. So if you want to join the conversation, you want to say hello, you want to sound off, you want to share your thoughts, the number for you is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. And love to hear from you, of course. Xi Jinping's address to the Chinese Congress, right? Did you follow any of that? I was overseas. I was abroad at the time. But I was watching a lot of this international news. You clearly heard a threat, right, against Taiwan, even against the West. And I spoke about this just briefly yesterday. Most military analysts believe an attack on Taiwan won't take place probably for a while. That's their speculation. I don't know, maybe not even for 5 years, possibly. But Admiral Gilday, the chief of naval operations, he told the Atlantic Council on Wednesday, you can't rule out an invasion of Taiwan. You just can't do it. They might do it this year. Yeah, I just want to pause on that for a second. I'll share with you what he said. But I was thinking about that statement, and I was thinking, you got to look at our leadership, right? Some people say that our president is compromised. I don't know whether that's the case or not. I don't. Okay, we'll see. I know history will ultimately reveal that. Quite often, the president, he is, you know, how he speaks sometimes. He came out, he spoke about how we would defend Taiwan, and then all of a sudden, White House officials walk back those statements, right? So where do we stand with Taiwan? And does China, after watching what Putin has done, they think now is an opportune time? You know, we've spent a lot of money. We sent a lot of our military weaponry. You know, our strategic oil preserves are at about half capacity. Listen to this. Listen to what the chief of naval operations told the Atlantic Council on Wednesday. He says, what we've seen over the past 20 years is that they have delivered on every promise that they've made earlier than they said that they would deliver on it. So when you talk about the 2017 window, in my mind, that had to be a 2027 window, he said. That's got to be 2022 or potentially 2023. He says, I can't rule it out. I don't mean to be an alarmist by saying that. We just can't wish it away. Which means we really need to begin praying, right? And I hope you do this. I do this every day, and I'm not saying this in any way to draw attention to me. I pray for Xi Jinping every day. I pray for Vladimir Putin. I pray for Joe Biden. I pray for these world leaders. I was in South America years ago with a great mystic. Her name was Maria Esperanza. And she was very accurate in her prophecies. Her cause is now underway. I was just with her vice postulator when I was overseas in Israel not too long ago. Esperanza had a lot of prophecies. Many of them had to do with strange new viruses and diseases that would crop up. Look, the world was struck with a pandemic on the eve of that. Her prophecies were so accurate. She'd say there's going to be an earthquake here in this month. And true to her prophecy, you know, there in Venezuela was an earthquake and a terrible mudslide that would follow. She warned about China is one of the things that she said. So I don't share that with you so you can fear. I don't want you to fear ever. I only share that with you because I think you and I, we can make a difference. We are called to pray. Right. And I say this every day as I open the show because I believe it. I am so convinced of it. Prayer mitigates things. Prayer alleviates things. Prayer changes things. And I did, you know, I believe the Iron Curtain fell because of so many rosaries that were prayed. You know, it took 70 years for that to happen. But I really believe that's why communism ended like a puff of smoke. There was no great war or conflagration. I believe Pope Francis's consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart, a lot of graces came. And I think we're going to see a surprising end to that conflict in Ukraine. But I think we need to also target our prayers right now, both asking for the mercy of God, but especially for what we are seeing overseas. And we need to pray for our own country. You know why I say that? Because I'm frustrated. We need to pray for the conversion of our military leaders. Yesterday, the Defense Secretary, Austin Lloyd, he came out and announced that the government will be putting aside a big pot of money for, you know what? Yeah, for military women and their dependents who are permanently stationed in the states that don't allow abortion, right? So what are they going to do? They're going to pay. They're going to pay for travel and transportation so that these women can damage themselves and, more importantly, destroy the life that God has given them in the womb. Here's a clip, again, from yesterday's Pentagon press conference about the new policy to fund travel and costs for abortion service for their members.
Today, Secretary Austin signed a memo directing the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness to oversee implementation of a number of initiatives designed to ensure reproductive health care access for our service members and their family members, and to bring clarity to DOD policies in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. The memo will be available on our defense.gov website and underscores the Secretary's top priority of taking care of our people and ensuring their health and well-being.
And of course, they're calling this reproductive health care. I said to my wife the other day, because I heard the soundbite come out, and I'm like, can somebody explain to me? I'm not the brightest guy in the room all the time, right? I like to think that I can comprehend. I like to think that I'm in the know. What's reproductive about abortion, right? Can somebody explain that? I mean, honestly, you ever think about that? Reproductive health care. There's nothing reproductive about what they're doing. This is what frustrates me. I'm a man of words, right? I make my living with my words, right? I communicate using words. And you see the manipulation of our language in such a way that it becomes mainstream and common. Reproductive health care. That's what they called, instead of really what it is, abortion. Murder, right? But newsflash for Secretary Lloyd. Once a baby's made, guess what? The reproduction is already happened. Killing that child is not health care. This is how twisted things have become. This is demonic. I'm going to say it again. I'm sorry I get passionate about it. It's outright demonic. Satan loves to twist, to distort. And you're seeing it. Actually, you're living it right now. That's what's happening in our own country. So the military is going to pay for dependents, right, to travel to states where they can get abortions. Why not pay to have women in states get health care for their babies, right, or to allow them to travel in times of need? But it raises one other question here about parents, right? Do parents know their rights? You're thinking, well, what do you mean by that? Well, right now, a lot of states and schools, they allow girls to get abortions. And this might be a newsflash, this might be a surprise, without their parents' knowledge or consent. I would be furious if my daughter got pregnant outside of marriage, she got pregnant, period, and the school or the state aborted that child without me knowing. You talk about a violation of parental authority and rights. I mean, I couldn't think of anything more wrong, but again, it goes back to the demonic. This is the hallmark of evils all over this. Satan hates the family, and he loves to destroy it. I'll tell you about an amendment that's been introduced in Congress to address that and other parental, you know, parent-child issues, if you will. Maggie was just saying to me here, I don't know if you could hear her, but she says, permission for aspirin? Is that what that says, Maggie? Is your mic open? Open your mic. Go ahead, share that real quickly.
Patrick just noted that there were permission slips that had to be brought home for kids to be able to use aspirin at school.
Oh gosh, that's so wrong. True, Patrick. Great point.
How ironic is that?
Yeah, you're right. You need a permission slip for aspirin but you can go ahead and have a really what it can be a life-threatening surgery. Women have died having abortions. There's complications all of the time, all the time. You know, there is an amendment right now that's been introduced in the Congress to address these issues. And the Parental Rights Amendment, I'll talk about this maybe next week or the week after. It's an important one. I just want you to be in the know for you, for your children, for your children's children. Let me just share what this Parental Right Amendment reads. One sentence. It says, quote, "The liberty of parents to direct the upbringing, education, and care of their children is a fundamental right," end of quote. I love that. The liberty of parents to direct the upbringing, education, and care of their children is a fundamental right. No kidding, right? So if it gets passed, it would bypass laws that say kids, you know, who want to have these frightening, life-changing decisions on their own without their parents' consent, you know, using birth control, getting abortions, going through sex changes. It's not going to happen. Go to parentalrights.org. You can find out much more about it. We'll talk about it later. I don't have time today to dive into that, but I just want to put that on your radar. One other issue here I want to share with you. President Biden, right? I don't know where you stand. Do you still have student loans? Do your kids have student loans, right? There was an emergency challenge to the president's student loan forgiveness effort, and it was actually denied by the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. And taxpayers there in Brown County, they sued in federal court claiming that the president had seriously violated the separation of powers. They wanted to halt the program from going into place. And of course, a lower court said that the group lacked standing, meaning that they actually had no right to bring the case. And when they appealed to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she upheld that lower court ruling. So far, the all legal challenges to the student loan forgiveness that the president wants to do, all those challenges have failed. So Supreme Court Justice Barrett not only rejected that appeal from this taxpayer group in Wisconsin, but listen to this. Listen to what went down.
Just a few hours ago, we just got word here in the newsroom that the court ruled on a challenge to the White House's plan to forgive some student loan debt. Now, it was Justice Amy Coney Barrett speaking for the court when she rejected a lawsuit from Wisconsin taxpayers. Now, she didn't ask for the administration side of things. She didn't send the suit to the full court. She just said no, rejected it.
Right. So here's the issue here. The group's right to bring the challenge in the first place. They're a group of taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And under normal circumstances, taxpayers can't sue the government over how it spends taxpayer dollars.
Yeah. Now, the plan forgives $20,000 in student loan debt for people who had Pell grants, $10,000 for those who had standard federal loans if they make less than $125,000 a year.
Yeah, so we'll see where this all shakes out. I don't know where you stand. And a lot of people who just don't think it's fair, just, or right. Other people are saying, my gosh, my poor kids, they could use $10,000 or $20,000 if you had a Pell Grant. But we'll see what happens. I think the president's going to be successful in this, to be honest with you. And we've already seen several people trying to hit the brakes on this, but we'll see what happens. One of his campaign promises, for all the things that I often say I don't respect about the president, especially when it comes to life, he is a man who made particular promises and is trying to honor them. I don't agree with all the things he vowed to do, but he's certainly trying to follow up on them. One last story here, just because it concerns your health, and I'm not sure whether you are aware of this or not. I found this to just be very telling. Plastic, right? I don't know if you drink out of plastic jugs or water bottles. You know, a lot of people are concerned about high levels of BPA. And I know they have BPA-free, you know, plastic bottles and cups and things like that now. But quite often it's found in very high levels. They're discovering now in clothing. BPA, if you're not familiar with it, it's actually an estrogen mimicker. And it can disrupt your body's normal functioning. Right. So the Center for Environmental Health sent out a legal letter to a number of major athletic clothing makers. So check this out. You might be wearing some of this athletic gear. Very high levels, supposedly, of BPA. Athleta, Pink, the North Face. I like North Face. Brooks, All in Motion, Nike, Philia, or Phyla, regarding sports bras, Mizuno. A whole bunch of other stuff. There are active wear shirts. There are undergarments that supposedly now have these high level of BPAs in them. So the CEH told the companies that they're the CEO, I should say, told their What am I saying? I'm fighting jet lag here, so bear with me as I try to get my head straight. Told companies that their clothing exposed wearers up to 22 times the level that was permitted under California law. So, I mean, there's a whole list of these things. I only went through a few of them, New Balance, Reebok, et cetera, their active shirt collections, et cetera. You know, do your own due diligence. And maybe if I can find that story that I saw earlier, I'll give it to Maggie and we can post it. But, you know, if you're concerned about, you know, these estrogen mimickers, I think you should be, you may want to get rid of that type of clothing. Or at least if you're going to shop for it, find out what's going on there. You know, they've done a lot with a lot of the water bottles and things to get that out. But I've talked about these estrogen mimickers that are in our water supplies and what it has done to wildlife and mutation of that wildlife. And it's something that should be of a major concern for you. You know, if you'll bear with me today, too, I'm not sure how articulate I am today. I got back very late on Wednesday night from being overseas, and my biological clock right now, it's very late at night for me, even though I'm broadcasting in the middle of the day. So with jet lag, you know, you hit these highs and these lows. I tried to have a cup of Java or two before I came on the air today, but I just don't feel like I'm as articulate as I normally am. So say a prayer with me and bear with me if I stammer, stutter, or somehow stall. We'll get through the show today together. All right. Clean water. Let's talk about that for a quick segment. And Bill Patenaude is going to be stopping by. Today's an interesting 50 years ago this month, Congress passed the Clean Water Act. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that at all. Normally, Congress passes, passing a bill is not really that big of a deal, right? In this case, it's a pretty big deal. The law came about after a series of lakes and rivers caught fire. Remember that famous case where Lake Erie actually caught fire? I don't know if you remember that or not. It was in Cuyahoga. The Cuyahoga River empties into Lake Erie in 1969. Train passing over the bridge gave off some sparks. They fell into the river. And as shocking as this is, those sparks, they actually ignited the pollution that was floating on this water. And the fire, they said, lasted, I think it was about a half an hour, but the news of it, it was enough to get the support of Congress to do something about cleaning up our nation's waterways. And the Clean Water Act was born. That was a half a century ago, 50 years ago this month. I just sit back and I wonder, what's the matter with people? How do you dump pollutants and trash into fresh water supplies? I mean, I never understood that. I'm glad we're past that, right? Today, you don't hear about lakes and rivers catching fire. Thanks be to God. Industrial waste now dealt with in cleaner ways, but you do hear, you know, about cases like the one the Supreme Court heard last week. I don't know if you're familiar with the Sackett versus the EPA, where the EPA won't let a couple build a house on their own property in Idaho because the EPA claims there are navigable waters on the property. So the question is, I mean, how do you balance the needs of the environment with the needs of the individual? And I've asked Bill Patenaude to stop by. He works in environmental management. He's got a wonderful degree also in theology. He wrote a great piece. You might want to check this out. He's been writing Catholic ecology. That's why I've invited him back. He's been here regularly for the Rhode Island Catholic, and I always appreciate his perspective. He wrote a science fiction novel. If you want a good read, check out A Printer's Choice. You can find that at that website, aprinterschoice.com. Hey, Bill, good afternoon. Welcome back.
Drew, thanks for having me. And from my perspective, you sound very eloquent, so I don't think you need to apologize.
It's been a rough couple of days. I haven't been home 48 hours, and it's a rough one. But I'm thank you for that. I appreciate that. Hey, give us a rundown, a breakdown, if you will, the nation's what they were like before the Clean Water Act was passed. I saw a documentary on what happened with Lake Michigan and the pollution that was going into that. I know a lot of our rivers were the same way. And, of course, the famous case of Lake Erie. But maybe paint a picture for those who don't know what it was like maybe 50 years ago.
Well, things were pretty bad. And for some of us of a certain age, we still remember smelling water bodies that did not smell like they should. And, you know, the great story about the Clean Water Act, for all the controversy that's going on with the Supreme Court and some of the fuzziness of the law, the original law, is that it is such a success. And, you know, when you've had me on many times, we talk about very complex issues like, you know, air pollution and plastics in the water. And some of these things seem almost unsolvable.
Right.
But the Clean Water Act is a great example of how both nationally and I know in my own state, in Rhode Island, there was really this wonderful communal effort between the government, the private sector, the non-NGOs, the advocacy groups, that really came together because we all saw and were experiencing the problems of pollution. I mean, not human health issues, quality of life issues, economic issues. And so the Clean Water Act was really a repackaging of federal water pollution control laws that were existed, but the 1972 law really emboldened it, elevated it. It had huge bipartisan support. The Congress passed it without Richard Nixon's support, not because he didn't support what it was doing, but just the price tag. Because one of the things that the law did was provide a lot of funding. They equalized standards. They required the nation as a whole to look at our wonderful gift of God of water and our oceans and our streams and our lakes, and say it has to be protected to certain levels. And that work continued and continued and continued. It provides citizens with tools to be part of the process. And so 50 years later, we have amazing success stories around the country. But I know in my own state in Rhode Island, we have this river called the Blackstone, the Patuxent, that were really just considered industrial sewers. You know, we're just going to dump whatever we want into the waterways and let it go out. And now we're stocking trout in them, and they're recreational opportunities, and they're really returning back to where God intended them to be. So it's a success story that I know sometimes when we talk about environmental issues, we can get really down because sure. they seem so huge. But the water quality issues of the 1950s and 60s seemed almost impossible, and we did That's it. True. So it's a sign of hope.
No, I agree, and I'm glad you bring up that point because it is positive. I could never get my head around. I mean, it just seems logical. Like, you don't want to dump trash or sewage or pollutants or chemicals, carcinogens in clean water or where you live or in your water supply. I mean, what was the rationale for that? Did we not have the technology at the time to filter this or properly dispose of it?
Well, there was always a cost involved. But, you know, the element that faith brings into environmental conversations is the reminder that we live in a fallen world.
Yeah.
So self-interest certainly was a factor here. So, and yeah, a little bit of ignorance. I mean, I think we learn that with air pollution too. We can, we have the sense that large waters of body are able to absorb this. And then if they don't, well, too bad, because we're making money. So there's self-interest, there's ignorance. It's all of the elements that are alive and well in a fallen world. And so, you know, as an environmental regulator and trainer and as someone who's an engineer with a theology degree, I can see all of this at work. And that's why I think the church is so important that John Paul II, Benedict XVI, Pope Francis are really engaging these issues. And many, many, many bishops, my own bishop is involved and very concerned about environmental protection, because the church really needs to be part of this conversation because of that point you made.
No, I couldn't agree more. I don't want to step on you. I want you to finish your thought because as I sit back
because the very point you made, because self-interest and ignorance and not caring about God's creation, not caring about our neighbor, not loving our neighbor, is a huge part, if not foundational, to so many problems in the world, but it's certainly environmental issues. And so in this case, we have a wonderful success story that really is a model. And it's not just that what Congress did and the money that came. It was really about the communities that came together to say, what are we doing? Yeah. Let's stop this and really clean up our water so we can fish and swim and our children have places to recreate and we can, sin and benefit from what God has given us, the beautiful waters of life. So it's really a beautiful story, and it's a model for all of the issues that we have deal with today.
Bill, final thoughts here. Just if I only have about a moment or two left for you. I'm curious as to where we are right now. So often we worship, it seems like, at the altar of nature. And there is a disconnect. I think sometimes people can go too far in that respect. I think we are called to be stewards of the environment God entrusted to us. We need to be good stewards of that. But there's also those that go too far. And the environment almost has become a religion. How do you draw the balance there to make sure that we fulfill our duty as stewards and not go to that extreme?
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. And this is why the voice of the church needs to be involved, to bring the gospel of life, to bring the message of the dignity of the human person from the moment of conception till natural death, to understand that we worship the Creator, not creation. Creation is this incredible gift of God that the more you examine it, the fact that life arose on this planet and it's just everything is just gift after gift, grace after grace from God. So that's why the church needs to be part of this conversation, because so much of the conversation tends to be dominated by those with worldviews that are really proposing a culture of death. And we need to be involved to bring the gospel of life.
Hey, Bill, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time. It's great to celebrate. Yeah, I will. It's good to celebrate some good news, right? This Clean Water Act has done some great things, and I think the environment will be better as a result of it. Hey, we'll catch up soon. Your book, A Printer's Choice, that's available, I'm assuming, online. Can people get it at Amazon as well, printerschoice.com?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we
thank you for mentioning that.
No, you got it. We'll talk again. Thank you. That's Bill Patnode, and today taking a look at the 50-year anniversary of something that has changed the country, the Clean Water Act. Stay with me. When I come back, we got a lot more to get into. Love to have you here. In fact, COVID. Overwhelming response to Dr. Harvey Risch, who was with me a couple weeks ago. You've heard about COVID vaccines soon being added to the childhood vaccination programs. We're going to take a look at how safe that is, answer your questions, and bring you up to speed on all that you need to know. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show. Connected.
Connected.
Relevant Radio.
This hour sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Centers for Disease Control Advisory Panel voted Thursday to add COVID shots to children's vaccine schedule. The vote means that it is recommended that kids begin getting doses of a COVID vaccine when they are 6 months old.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, COVID back in the news, right? That came from Fox on the CDC's new ruling to add the COVID vaccine to children's vaccination schedules. How do you feel about it? I'd love to hear from you. You want to sound off? The number's 888-914-9149. A couple weeks ago, maybe even a month ago now, I forget the last time I had Dr. Harvey Risch on, but boy, the response was overwhelming to him. I know many of you follow his work and appreciate his perspective. I do want to talk a little bit about COVID today. We'll answer the questions that you have. We'll take a look at the side effects to this. But more importantly, I want to take a look at what it means for your children. The winter is coming, right? The winter is going to be here before you know it. And what's that mean? You're going to enter cold and flu season. So on top of that, you've got health officials concerned we're going to see a comeback of COVID. In fact, I won't disclose their name, but one of my colleagues here at Relevant just came down with COVID. So, you know, you think it's behind you. You think it's in your rearview mirror. And what happens? Somebody you know has it. There's all these new variants that are starting to make their way around the country. Officials believe that these variants are making the virus now even more transmissible, able to skirt around the immune defenses, though they don't appear to have said anything about whether the changes make them more dangerous, and I'm hoping that that's not the case, but that's why the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration are encouraging people to get boosters this winter. A lot of people say, no thanks. I've had, you know, a couple shots already, and I'm still getting COVID. I don't want the booster. Only 10%, right? 1 out of 10 of those who've already been vaccinated are getting boosters. Why is that, huh? 1 out of 10? Really? 10%? It's pretty low. I think there's a good case for it. We could talk about it. Yesterday, though, the CDC took a vote. They took a vote on whether to recommend that COVID shots be added to what is already a lengthy list of vaccinations that your kids have to get. And the vote was unanimously in favor of doing that. So that doesn't mean that all kids are going to have to get it, but some states might add it to the list of shots that you need to get before you can go into public school. And I'm thinking probably most are going to jump on board. You know, even though the vote was unanimous, it's really not being received all that well outside the CDC, right? I mean, Congressman Chris Smith, who's been a friend of this radio program, he hails from New Jersey. This is what he said. He said, quote, "When will the Biden administration release the critical data. When will the Biden administration release this data, including clinical trials, that demonstrate both the safety and the efficacy of vaccinating millions of children? As a parent, if I had a kid going to grade school or needed a shot to enter public school, you darn right I want to know what the data is. I want to know. I want to know what the clinical trials reveal. Is it safe? And is it efficacious? If not, I may not want my kid to get it, especially if he goes on to this. He says, quote, especially if states make the shot mandatory and a requirement for schools. He wants the Biden administration to release all this stuff. He says parents need to have all the facts on such a critical decision impacting their children's present and potentially future health. Does the COVID vaccine impact a child's future health? He's not alone. Marty, what's his last name? Marty McCary. Is that his name? McCary? McCary. I'm zoning out on his name. Like I said, I'm tired. I'm firing all cylinders today. He's a surgeon, a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He was on, I think, Tucker Carlson on Fox News, and he says there has never been a vaccine added to the child immunization schedule without solid clinical evidence that it reduces disease significantly in the community. Did you grab that audio by any chance? I know John Morales was sharing it with us a little bit earlier today and said he had a great soundbite. Anyway, he said look, the audio of McCary is excellent. The COVID vaccine, McCary said, in children will be the first, and it will be added with no clinical data. My question is why, right? Why? Why don't we have the data, and why are we pushing this on our children? That's the big question. Well, Dr. Harvey Risch is a professor emeritus of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and the Yale School of Medicine. He was with us, as I said, not too long ago. I'm grateful for his time. He joins us once again. Doctor, so good to have you back. Thank you for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you.
Maybe you could answer that question. I mean, again, I go back to Dr. Marty McCary, who's saying, you know, there's never been a vaccine added to child immunization schedule without solid evidence that it reduces disease significantly. And this is going to be the first, and it's being added without clinical data. What do you make of that? And should parents be concerned? I mean, I just want to be objective. If it's good, it's going to keep everybody safe, then great. If you have reservations, I'd love to know what they are.
Well, in my opinion, this is irrational and bizarre from the logical medical point of view. And I say that because on August 11th, the CDC came out and said that two doses of the vaccines do not prevent the transmission of COVID, and boosters provide only transient benefit that wanes. So to me, transient means a short period of time, which means that the boosters are not a usable tool for public health management of the pandemic. And you might have noticed since that time that the CDC has only laid claim to the vaccines and or the boosters for supposed reduction in risk of hospitalization and mortality. They have said nothing about transmission because they've admitted that it doesn't work. Now, why that's important is that the government has only has one compelling interest in mandating vaccines, and that is that they prevent spread.
Right.
The CDC admitted that they don't prevent spread, so the government has no compelling interest in mandating vaccines, and that means adults, it means children, it means anyone. If the vaccines don't prevent spread, the government has no interest whatsoever, no compelling interest, which is one reason, one grounds in law that the government can even weigh in on this. And that was settled in 1905 in the Jacobson case in the Supreme Court, which found that governments need to have a compelling interest that the vaccine be efficacious for reducing spread, that the who gets vaccinated isn't arbitrary and capricious, and vaccinating people who've already had COVID is arbitrary and capricious. So you can see that all of the criteria for the government interest in mandating vaccines, none of them are met by the COVID vaccines, and in particular, they're not met for children. So the government has no grounds to mandate it. State governments have no grounds to mandate it. It doesn't matter. If they put it on the childhood schedule, you know, I'm betting that they're going to be sued, that they have no grounds. It's malfeasance to do that because of vaccines, we are told by the government, do not work for preventing spread.
Doctor, what do you make of so many people rejecting the booster shots. I know people initially got their double shots, the first two, and then the booster, third booster came out fourth. I'm hearing that 1 in 10 people now are choosing not to get any more, or 1 in 10 are getting these additional boosters, but that means 9 out of 10 aren't. What do you make of that? Are people concerned? Are they not seeing this as being truly a vaccine? It seems to operate more like a flu shot. What are you seeing, and what's the rationale of the American people right now for that?
Well, I think the people who are still willing to get these vaccines, to take the vaccines, have a large component of anxiety or fear about the pandemic. And everybody else is basically saying, we've seen not just that the CDC said that these things don't work, but in our own life, in our friends and acquaintances and public figures and so on, fully vaccinated people that keep coming down with COVID. So we know that they don't prevent transmission. And since we know that from personal experience, what's the point? Yeah. I think that's reasonable.
My guest today, if you want to join us, Dr. Harvey Risch. Our number here, 888-914-9149. Doctor, let's take a call or two for you. Let's go to California first. George has been waiting the longest. George, hi. You're on the air, Dr. Risch.
Hello. This is George from California. And my comment is that I agree with the doctor 100%. We don't even know the effects on the adults, never mind children. Before we go to the children, we need to make sure that it is a vaccine. It's not even a vaccine. It doesn't prevent. And then the other thing is, I got a question. If they do mandate it, are they still under the emergency, like where these pharmaceutical companies are providing the vaccine with immunity from lawsuits? Is that still the case?
All right, great questions, George. Thank you, Doctor. I'll let you respond.
So yes, that once the vaccine manufacturers do have immunity from prosecution in lawsuits by the PREP Act from a few years ago. But that is further cemented by once a vaccine is put on the children's schedule, they have complete immunity. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you whether if it's found and proven that they committed fraud in developing or representing the vaccine, whether that removes their legal immunity. Lawyers will have to weigh in on that, so that's possible. But aside from that, putting the vaccine on the childhood schedule does protect the vaccine manufacturers.
Yeah, all right. My guess, as I said, Dr. Harvey Risch. Doctor, I'm going to take a short pause when we come back. I'd like to get your take on these new variants that are now cropping up. I also want to talk about, like, your perspective on whether or not children need to be vaccinated against the disease at all. You know, do we even need to give these kids this particular vaccine for COVID? We'll get into that. We'll take a few more calls. I said I only have a few moments left with Dr. Harvey Risch. The number here to get in, if you got a question, a comment, and you want to join the conversation, 888-914-9149. You can call now.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Tell one friend about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy.
I'm not holding a small cup, Drew. I'm holding an extra large cup.
A bucket.
Every weekday at 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's great to be back here with you. We'll take a few of your calls. My guest today, the very prestigious, the very sought after, the very wise, Dr. Harvey Risch, a professor emeritus of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine. And we're just talking COVID. You might have heard the news. The CDC is recommending COVID shots for your kids. Should your children get them? And what happens if it's mandated for your school to get it? What are you going to do in that case? There's a lot to talk about. As always, time is the enemy. One of the things I've been tracking is this. There's a new Omicron COVID-19 subvariant on the rise. That's according to the CDC. You got BQ1 and BQ1.1 subvariants together, and they're driving about 11% of the recent cases, but these new offshoots of Omicron, of this COVID-19 variant, they say it spreads very easily, and it's on the rise right now in the country. The latest federal data shows really how the virus, it's underscoring is probably a better word of how the virus is mutating and presenting new risks as it continues to proliferate. And what do you need to know? You know, how dangerous is this? You know, with these new variants coming up, even though they're more easily transmitted, are they more dangerous? Doctor, let's start there, then we'll grab a few calls. What do we know about these new variants? I know as Omicron tries to, as the COVID-19 variants try to continue to live, they become more communicable, but quite often they become less lethal. What do we know about this? And are they becoming less lethal? Is it something to be concerned about? Fill us in.
Well, interestingly, the still majority circulating virus strain is BA5, but it's close to being pushed to the minority strain in another week or two by these growing variants. A couple of weeks ago, I've been following the variants on the CDC's website. A few weeks ago, it was being pushed out by BA4.6. However, that seems to have stalled. And in the meantime, the ones you mentioned, BQ1, BQ1.1, seem to be accelerating, doubling each week approximately.
Wow.
And that implies that they're more infective, more transmissible than BA4.6, which is more transmissible than BA5. So by mid-December or late December, we're likely to be seeing these BQ1, BQ1.1 strains as the predominant strains, unless something else that we don't see quite much at the moment pushes them out. And this is the way the virus works.
Yep.
So the real question here is, if people are choosing to take a booster that's based on BA1,
right,
what good will that do if the strain is BQ1 and
right,
BQ1.1 and so on by the
right
time the booster actually has its very short-lived benefit?
So your advice to parents, you know, if I was a parent with a young child right now, maybe there are grandparents listening who have grandkids, is it safe for kids to get this, and do children even need to be vaccinated?
So let me take the second question first. The answer is children in general do not need to be vaccinated. Most children get this infection either asymptomatically or with very mild symptoms. A day of listlessness and fever is usually about the most that most children have with this. Older children can get sore throats and so on a little more. In general, for healthy children, there is no need to be vaccinated. One gets natural immunity, which is better than vaccine immunity, by having the mild cases of COVID. That being said, there are children who need to evaluate whether it might be in their interest to be vaccinated. These are children with childhood diabetes or obesity or who've had cancer and are immunocompromised, have chronic kidney disease, things like that. Children who have serious chronic conditions, they need to speak to a doctor who's open to giving or not giving the vaccines based on medical reasoning. And you have to balance the risks of getting COVID in those kinds of children with the risks from getting the vaccines in those kinds of children. So that's a relatively small minority of children, and the great majority of children do not need to be vaccinated. The risk of dying from COVID has been estimated from CDC data as 3 in 100,000 cases, and from an analysis of worldwide data, 3 in 1,000,000 cases. The FDA's, or I guess CDC's data on 3 in 100,000 is probably based on children dying with as well as from COVID. And that is a cloud over the data that has not been lifted. So we don't really know how accurate that is. But you can see that the mortality risk in healthy children is essentially zero, virtually zero, statistically zero, as close as you can get to that, like being struck by lightning. And so there's no reason
right
for children to get the vaccines in that context, healthy children to get the vaccines in that
right
context.
That makes sense.
Now, the flip side is, well, what if I'm forced to have to get the vaccine and I accede to that, I give my children the vaccines, what's the risk from that? So the answer to that is two things. Number one, the risks of bad outcomes like myocarditis and so on are not trivial. They're somewhere on the order, the Thailand study says it's 1 in 3 in adolescent young adult males. It might not be that high. Other studies have suggested 1 in 200, 1 in 2,000. Those are relatively low risks. And therefore, what people normally take those kinds of risks in daily life and society to some degree, and we don't really think about them. You know, we go driving in traffic, even though there's 40 or 50,000 traffic deaths a year.
Yeah.
So we take risks that we need to in order to live our daily lives. And so the question is this a necessary risk that needs to be taken? And the answer to that is most children will squeak by and not be harmed by this, but there will be an appreciable number who are seriously harmed or killed from the vaccines. And
wow.
So you when you vaccinate 70 million children, mm-hmm. you're going to have tens of thousands who are severely harmed.
Wow.
And for those families, that was bad. But the other, 70 million, they're going to kind of get away with it. Now, in the longer term, we don't know because the vaccines have only been studied for a couple of years and less than that in children. And so we don't know what the 3, 5, 10-year risks are. Of other things that could happen to children by taking these vaccines, there's no information. We won't know for another 3, 5, or 10 years.
So true. All right, let's grab a few quick telephone calls. A lot of people have questions for you. Emily, good afternoon. Listening to us in Boston, Massachusetts. Good to have you on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. It's a pleasure speaking to both of you.
Thank you.
And actually, my question is, I took the vaccine and the booster twice. And on June, I have been diagnosed with the optic neuritis on my left eye. So I'm not sure if this is related to the vaccine or because I was reading on the some studies, they said the optic neuritis cases, it's getting worse with the people. Most people, they took the vaccine.
Oh, wow.
And that's my question. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Doctor, your thoughts on that?
So I can't give medical advice here, but my thought is that it's possible, and whether or not it came from the vaccine, it should be treated and dealt with by, an ophthalmologist or a neurologist, somebody who's willing to use medications like steroids, ivermectin, and other medications to try to quell that kind of inflammation.
Following up on her call there, we know myocarditis is higher with young men who've had this vaccination. What about fertility? And we're talking about we're talking about vaccinating children here. Does this affect their ovaries, the female population? Does it affect fertility at all? Maybe you can't answer that, but I'd love to get your take if you can.
Well, honestly, I can't answer because the data are controversial and insecure.
Yeah.
We don't know what the real data are because the CDC has been hiding data and playing games with the data for 2.5 years. So we just don't know. People anecdotally report lots of menstrual irregularities. We know the vaccines do go to the ovary and for at least some period of time.
Right.
And so we just don't know. There people have thought that there are effects on fertility, but whether there's empirical evidence of that is very hard to settle out. So I can't speak definitively on that.
All right. We'll move along then. We'll go to Diane in Boston as well. Diane, good afternoon. You are on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. there's so many things wrong with this. So many things. I don't have enough time to list them. Number one, they have been calling this a vaccine. It is not a vaccine. And it is from what I understand, a gene therapy inoculation. We have never had anything like this. So people have been going to their doctors under the pretense that they are going to get a quote unquote vaccination that has been offered through the years, and they are not. They're getting an experimental gene. We're basically lab rats.
All right, Diane, let me hold you on that thought because I have a couple of minutes here. I want the doctor to respond. I mean, yeah, I've heard that before, people saying this is a gene therapy inoculation. It is a huge human clinical trial, that's for sure. Doctor, your thoughts on that? We call it a vaccination, but unlike the MMR or some of the other vaccinations we get, COVID has all these variants and it seems relatively ineffectual in the long run. But your thoughts to Diane and some final thoughts from you as well.
So I agree it's mislabeled as a vaccine, but it functions in its end result as if it were a vaccine. And I think that what it's labeled only serves to confuse people, because people think in a very simplistic, theoretical way, vaccine equals good.
Yeah.
And they don't address the ramifications of what the actual vaccine does. And it's not just the COVID vaccine. The HPV vaccine has also had some issues. The other vaccines have been pretty good, but we know we've had to take things like mercury out of the thimerosal, out of them over time, and so on, as we learn what the vaccines do. And by and large, they've been good, but it's not 100%. So this is an evolving thing, but we know for sure that the COVID vaccines do not get a free pass on the idea that they're just good vaccines.
Yeah. Marie in Illinois, you've got to make it very quick because I have about a moment left for the doctor. Go right ahead.
Yes, just really quick. I got all three shots. I'm 50 years old, and I have actually had a lot of issues. I have fibroids. They've gotten bigger. Even my gynecologist has said she's not sure what's been happening after the 3 years. I go, maybe with the shots. The other thing is I have actually had menstrual for a whole month.
Wow.
That stopped as well. I went to get an ultrasound done, and the technician had said that I was not the only one who's having these issues.
Yep.
She also said that she's had patients where they can't get pregnant anymore.
Wow. Doctor, final thoughts. I have about 30 seconds for you. You heard Marie. Anything you want to leave with us?
Well, all of these things are plausible. There is empirical evidence that they're happening, that we've been gaslighted, that, oh, no, everything is safe, that the government has withheld information about all the adverse events and denied the adverse events. But that is something that the CDC has done routinely for its almost entire existence.
Right.
And it's not the only country where that happens. So that, unfortunately, is endemic.
Doctor, my thanks to you. Always grateful to have you here. I'd love to have you back. That's Dr. Harvey Risch. I'll be right back.